the seconds tick down. The Western Conference Finals are done. The Phoenix Suns, for the first time in 28 years, are going back to the NBA Finals.
And to do it here in LA with the Clippers, this is my family too. I gave 6 hard years to the Clippers. We fought hard. A lot of these fans, Billy Crystal, that's my family.
Chris Paul, the Phoenix Suns star point guard, after beating his former team last night to advance to the NBA Finals. The Sklar brothers will be here later in the hour to recap last night's Western Conference Finals that sent the Clippers home. First, though, we're going to pivot to a different court, the Supreme Court. Earlier today, the 9 justices issued 2 opinions we've been waiting for, both involving elections. One upholds Arizona's voting restrictions, and another says California cannot force nonprofits to reveal their big donors. It's not a Monday, but Jessica Levinson is here anyway, Loyola Law School professor and our regular Legal Eagle. Hi.
Happy Thursday and happy end of the 2020-2021 Supreme Court term. The only court that matters. Hello.
I know there is a little basketball court at the Supreme Court, I understand. But anyway, let's talk about what's happening with election law. This is, well, it's right in your wheelhouse. So let's first talk about the Arizona case and what happened there. What were the justices considering?
So the justices were considering 2 different provisions of Arizona's law. One dealt with what happens when you go to vote on election day and you walk into the wrong precinct. Well, what happens in Arizona is that your entire ballot is trashed. Scenario number 2, what happens in Arizona if you want to give somebody else your ballot to turn in early? In Arizona, that somebody else has to be a pretty narrow group of people. If it's not a mail carrier, it has to be a family member or somebody you live with or a caretaker. Both of those provisions were challenged as violating Section 2, that's the remaining section in the Voting Rights Act. And after oral arguments, it was pretty clear the justices are going to say that these 2 Arizona laws are okay, and they did. The big question was, how big are they going to go? Are they going to say the Voting Rights Act is still really powerful, but it just is that these particular laws don't violate it? Or will they whittle down the Voting Rights Act? I would argue they picked door number 2 today.
That they whittled down the Voting Rights Act. So explain that part of it. And this was a really ideological split on the court, 6-3, right, with the with Justice Alito writing the majority opinion.
Yes, this is one of those typical 6-3 divisions. Justice Alito writing, Justice Elena Kagan writing a scathing dissent in a way that people on Twitter might say, I'd like to report a murder, because she was so aggressive in her dissent. And she said, this is a law-free zone. She said the majority wasn't citing to any law. Now you asked me, kind of, how did they whittle down the Voting Rights Act? And the answer is that, you know, for so many of these cases, they really live and die on how hard or how easy it is to prove a violation. And what the court said today, what Justice Alito said today, is it's going to be really, really hard to prove that your votes were diminished, that your voting rights were harmed under the Voting Rights Act. And Justice Kagan says, you basically made this up. It doesn't even belong in our case law. It's not consistent with the text of the Voting Rights Act. But, you know, the end for all of us is to know that people who want to challenge voting laws are going to have a much steeper hill to climb after today's decision.
And the argument on the part of Justice Kagan was what? That actually these 2 provisions in the law disproportionately affected minorities because they are, for one, more likely to move around and therefore cast their votes in different precincts, and 2, rely more on so-called ballot harvesting?
Exactly. And she said, you know, this isn't my argument. This is backed up by what was found in the lower court. The lower courts found that while it might not be an enormous number of people whose votes are affected by these Arizona laws, What matters is the disproportionate impact. And she said, we have that here for the reasons that you just outlined. And she has a really passionate, as I said, dissent, where she said the Voting Rights Act is the best of us because we try to protect people's right to vote. And it's the worst of us because it's a solution to a very real problem. And this dissent is almost as long as the majority. And she lays out, why did we need the Voting Rights Act? What does it say? And why today she thinks the court erred, and why she would have found that this is exactly the type of situation that should be protected under the Voting Rights Act.
So what does this mean more broadly? Because as we've been discussing on this show, there are lots of attempts in lots of states to restrict voting rights. And we, you and I discussed earlier this week, the Department of Justice case against Georgia. They're bringing a suit against Georgia's new law. And so does this case complicate that effort and efforts more broadly to fight back against restrictions on voting rights?
I think the answers are yes, no, no. So more broadly speaking, yes, it means that it will be more complicated for people who are trying to challenge more restrictive voting laws. And we know that there have been more than two dozen restrictive voting laws that have been passed throughout the country. There are hundreds of bills pending at this very moment. The reason I said no is that the Georgia case is styled somewhat differently. The Georgia case, and I think this was very smart strategically, the Department of Justice said Georgia actually intended for there to be a discriminatory purpose here. They intended this discriminatory purpose. Mm-hmm. And so that would fall outside of this decision, which was really about impacts and results. So I think the Department of Justice was anticipating a bad decision and took a posture that would allow them potentially to succeed, even though, you know, as you and I know, it's really hard to prove what somebody's intent was and really hard to prove discriminatory intent.
Okay, well, let's talk about this other opinion, and this involves California. And this was also a 6-3 decision on ideological lines. And the court said California cannot require charities to report their major donors to the state. They said that violates the First Amendment. So what exactly are they saying there with this ruling?
Yeah, what exactly happened here? So I think what you said is exactly right, which is that there was this requirement that major donors to nonprofits have to provide their, I think it's called Schedule Bs, to the California Attorney General. The idea is that the Attorney General's office oversees nonprofits, and they need to make sure that nonprofits that are spending money, doing business, functioning in California are not engaging in fraud, or and that they're properly using the corporate form. And so that's why they said they need this information. What the court said today is a couple of things. One, they said, California, no, you really don't. You're not bringing fraud prosecutions. You just want this information because it's easier for you than having to ask the IRS. And so an administrative ease is not a reason that's important enough under the First Amendment to force people to give you this information. But I actually think the much more important thing that the court said, again, kind of relates to what we were just talking about, which is about standards. And Chief Justice Roberts says it's a high standard to prove that a disclosure provision is needed. Now, this might sound like it's a case about nonprofits, it's a case about major donors, it's not even information that should be publicly available. Why does all this matter? It matters because in the wake of Citizens United, so much money flows in our political system. The promise of Citizens United was don't worry about all the money because we have disclosure provisions and we will uphold those disclosure provisions. Today, the court said, disclosure provisions, you're subject to a high level of review, meaning it's going to be easier to challenge those.
Mm. All right. Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law Professor and our Thursday Legal Eagle. Thank you.
Thank you.
San Jose Jose, California could become the first city in the nation to require gun owners to carry liability insurance. The city could also impose an annual fee for gun owners. The idea is to get them to compensate the city for the costs of gun violence, like police and ambulance service and medical care costs. And it's all part of a plan the city council approved this week to explore how it might work. An official vote on these gun regulations could come in September. Well, this comes as the city is still grieving from that mass shooting in May where a gunman killed 9 of his coworkers in the Santa Clara Valley Transportation Authority. We're going to talk about this now with Raul Perales. He is a San Jose City Council member, and he also lost a close friend in that shooting. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and my condolences to you. I'm very sorry for the loss of your friend. That must be difficult for
Thank you. Yeah, it certainly has been a challenging past month.
Right. And did it weigh on you or did it influence you as you were considering this proposal?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, inevitably something like that is going to affect all the decisions, really, I think, quite frankly. Moving forward, especially those that revolve around, you know, gun safety, mental health, you name it, right? I think this is now going to factor into a lot of decisions that I make.
Interesting. And so this particular proposal, I understand, was in the works before the rail yard shooting, right?
Yeah, this is actually a couple years old. So I know there was a lot of community response that felt that it may have been a knee-jerk reaction from our mayor in the council, but that's actually not the case. This is something that the mayor and, in fact, myself, I've been working on it with him for the past couple years. His team has spent a lot of time in working with our city attorney to try and find a policy that, number one, would be legal, but then, two, would address the concerns that we had. And that's where we found ourselves at earlier this week on Tuesday with a policy finally to be able to come forward.
Okay, well, go into detail, if you would, as to what this policy would do, because on the face of it, it sounds kind of like when you have a car, you pay a registration fee and you also have to carry insurance. So is it similar for gun owners?
Yep. At the core of it, it's really not much different than what we as community members are used to with things like our vehicle. We have to register it. There's also all kinds of other things you got to do with your driver's license, take a written test and take a driving test. You update that, right, all the time. You pay your registration every single year. And as we know, insurance, right? There's now a requirement that you have insurance. Every state has different limits and levels. And so we're very used to these. We're just not somehow, right, they become controversial when we talk about them around firearms.
How much money does gun-related violence cost the city of San Jose?
We were estimating that at over $400 million of cost to the, you know, whether it's local, state, or county governments, total cost. And you're talking about things like a police response, a firefighter's response, the ambulance, right, and then the hospital fee, you name it, all of those are taxpayer expenses. And so that's why we're able to generate a fee from what the taxpayer actually is, the burden on the taxpayer.
You're saying it costs San Jose $400 million a year?
Yeah, the tallies that we came up with were over $440 million
wow.
for annual cost of firearm injury or death.
And that's just in the city of San Jose?
Yeah, that's just within the city of San Jose, but it's not only a city cost, because some of this is county, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we're going to have to do a breakdown to determine how much of it is city service, which would be, for instance, our San Jose police officers or our San Jose firefighters. And so those costs will be costs borne on the city, and that analysis will be now that we, you know, this vote passed unanimously on Tuesday, that analysis will have to be completed before we determine what the actual fee will be for the city of San Jose.
So this will inevitably face a legal challenge. I can see it now. And that could cost the city a lot, right? I mean, that could cost the city maybe millions of dollars. I don't know.
Absolutely. Yeah, no doubt. The legal challenge would be both handled in-house. So we have, right, the city of San Jose, 10th largest city in the country. We have a full team of in-house attorneys that are getting paid regardless. And so it wouldn't actually be some sort of additional cost unless we were to hire outside firms. And in this case, we've actually already had outside firms that have offered up pro bono service to also aid the support of our city attorney team. So we actually don't expect and would not plan to pay any additional dollars to try and fight this in court.
So is this a pretty much a done deal? You're just figuring out the specifics?
It will have to come back to the council again. And we did have some, you know, there was some debate, no doubt, on the council dais on Tuesday. There was concern from a handful of council members on some of these issues and, right, what the fee might be, what the total tally is. And so when this comes back as where the actual fee has been calculated, I do expect there'll be more debate on that. And so I wouldn't call it a done deal just yet.
Is the ultimate goal a financial one, or is it a gun control one? In other words, what is the animating issue here for you? And as someone who lost a good friend in that San Jose,
yeah, the overwhelming goal, at least for me, it would be reducing gun violence. That is the overarching goal. It's not about that generating that fee. It's not about simply the cost. It is overarchingly about reducing gun violence and gun harm.
Raul Perales, City Councilman in San Jose, California. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Coming up, the Clippers' dreams are dead. We'll talk about last night's game with the Sklar brothers next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
Well, the Clippers are out of the NBA playoffs after a formidable postseason run, knocked out last night by the Phoenix Suns, 130-103. But the Clips did not go gently into that good night. After it was pretty much hopeless, Patrick Beverley, point guard for the Clips, shoved Suns star and former Clippers star Chris Paul in the back.
That's as unsportsmanlike as it gets. Patrick Beverley losing control.
Paul said something to him. And he reacted inappropriately.
You've been chirping all series
That's
long.
Right.
Now's not the time to react that way.
Okay, well, Wimbledon is also in full swing, so to speak. Dodgers are second in their division. Here to talk about it all are, of course, the Sklar brothers, Randy and Jason. Hi, you guys.
How are you?
I am well. Okay, well, let's talk about what happened last night. What happened last night?
So the Clippers lost, and they lost Game 6. It actually looked promising for them as they beat Phoenix in Phoenix to bring it to a game six. They were down 3-1, one in Phoenix in game five to bring it to a game six. And you thought, okay, they're playing at home. There's maybe a home court advantage to at least take it to the seventh game. And you never know what's going to happen in a game seven, but they just fell flat. You really felt like, you know, the Clippers were doing all of this without Kawhi Leonard, who got injured earlier. And if you don't have your number one guy, you're looking at the Suns, and they have Chris Paul has been amazing. Their young player, Devin Booker, you know, a lot of people have drawn comparisons to Kobe, Devin Booker, that he's that type, that could be that quality of a player. And DeAndre Ayton, they have their three intact, and the Clippers just look decimated, right, Jay?
They did, and they were relying a lot on Paul George, who, you know, he's a star in his own right, but he was the star that the Clippers got in order to bring the bigger star, Kawhi Leonard, to the Clippers. So you got to wonder, had it been reversed, if Paul George had gotten hurt and Kawhi was still playing, maybe the Clippers would have advanced further. But you got to give credit to the Clippers backup players, players like Reggie Jackson, who had over nine games. He had, I think, 9 or 10 games scoring 20 points or more in the postseason. Guys like Patrick Beverley, before he lost his mind and pushed Chris Paul in the back, he played great defense. You had other players on the team who really stepped up. And the Clippers team, the backup players played well, but they were missing that lead guy. And Paul George, one game would have a good game, the next game wouldn't, and it cost the Clippers the series. But they got further than they've ever gotten. That's encouraging. In 51 years, they made it all the way to the Western Conference Finals. If both guys come back healthy next year, there's a lot of promise and positive thinking, certainly around even a coach who stepped up and made his mark, Tyronn Lue. He really... you know, he was exposed in a good way as being a great coach. And so there's a lot to be positive about, even though Clippers fans are nursing a sad hangover the next day.
Yeah, I know. Sorry, Billy Crystal. But what went on, sort of, what was the meta analysis of that shove? Because Chris Paul, you know, he did have some nice things to say about the Clippers. He was there, what, for 6 years? Yeah.
I mean, he was really the heart of the Clippers for a long time during that great run in Lob City. He and Blake Griffin and DeAndre Jordan. I mean, he was the guy who made it run. And you look at a guy like Chris Paul, who is sort of in the later part of his career, and he has made every team that he's been on better. You know, Phoenix had these two young great players in DeAndre Ayton, the center, and Devin Booker, who's just, they're great players. They're fantastic players. But they needed that older sort of presence there, that guy who could stabilize the team and give it sort of, you know, playoff experience and whatnot and carry them through in moments. And Chris Paul really stepped up. I mean, he had over 40 points last night in a game that they had to win on the road. And I just think he feels comfortable in the Staples Center. So to me, this is a really good thing. If I can compare it to a different sport, last year the Dodgers won the World Series, and Jason and I, as fans of baseball, were happy for a guy like Clayton Kershaw, a guy who had been to the World Series a number of times but didn't have a ring. That's a Hall of Fame player, first ballot Hall of Famer. Same with Chris Paul. Now, you know, we're not rooting for certain teams and whatnot, but you kind of root for a guy like Chris Paul that maybe he makes it to the NBA Finals, and maybe this is the year that a guy that good can win a ring. And so what's happening with him and Patrick Beverley is that Patrick Beverley is a competitor. He likes to get under your skin. He likes to get under the best player's skin and really mentally try and break him down. You know, there was a moment in the game before in game five where Beverley was fighting through a screen and accidentally clipped Paul's legs, and Paul flopped pretty hard. You know, it wasn't really a foul, but Beverley then got up and literally, to the Phoenix crowd, jokingly, mockingly showed them twice how Chris Paul flopped. It was, you know, Chris Paul wasn't getting up off the floor, so you don't know if he's really hurt or not. It seemed to be a little bit of poor taste, but that sort of jawing back and forth was going on through the whole series. And I think at that point, when the game got out of control, Patrick Beverley just lost it and pushed him in the back.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's update your predictions, because Jason, you said that this was going to be the year the Clippers were going to break through to the finals. So,
yeah, well, two games away, they got close.
Okay, doesn't count.
Close.
Randy, you had Brooklyn winning, also out.
Yeah, and Brooklyn had a shot too, but injuries, and this is really the story, Madeline, of the whole playoffs. It's a war of attrition, basically. If your best guys are injured, you're going to be, it's all about keeping your guys healthy. You look over in the Eastern Conference Finals, and the best player on the Atlanta Hawks, Trae Young, who is an amazing young player, incredible guard. He shoots it from half court and sinks it, kind of like a young Steph Curry almost. He got injured, and so he wasn't playing for the Hawks. And then Giannis Antetokounmpo, who is really one of the, known as the Greek Freak, the MVP in the NBA this year, he got injured and hyperextended his knee in the last game. So, you know, with these stars dropping, you look at Phoenix and you start to say, wow, they kept their entire roster intact. I mean, Chris Paul got injured a little bit in some of the earlier series. He went into COVID protocol for a little while. And so, you know, that was a problem for them. But now they're coming into these NBA finals healthy, whereas whoever they're facing.
Who are they going to play in the finals?
I mean, it's 2-2 in the East. They play tonight, I think. I don't know. Really, truthfully, I don't know. I would have said Milwaukee if Giannis wouldn't have gotten injured. But now I think it's anybody's game. I actually think the Hawks may emerge. Jay, what do you think?
Okay.
I think the Hawks may emerge, and not to correct you, Randy, but Giannis did not win MVP this year. That was Nikola Jokic from the Denver Nuggets.
Right. Sorry.
Sorry to correct you on the air, but
yeah, but good fact checking there,
anyway.
Jason.
But I did it anyway. But
he was a finalist.
I think the Atlanta Hawks will be playing the Phoenix Suns, and I think this will be the year that Phoenix wins a championship. Book it, mark it, because I said it, it'll probably go a different direction.
Okay, speaking of injuries, quickly let's talk about Wimbledon, because Serena is out with an injury. What's happening there?
She retired not from the sport, but from her match. First time she's retired from a major since 1998, Wimbledon. Really sad, because it's pretty wide open. With Naomi Osaka not playing, it's pretty wide open, and Serena might have had a shot. What happened was, there's a lot of rain in England during this period of time, which there typically is. And, I mean, it is England, it is London, but the court, they had to close the roof. The court itself, the grass court, was getting a little bit wet, and a lot of players slipped. I mean, the guy that Roger Federer was playing in the first round, he had to retire because of injury in that match. And he was literally took Roger Federer to a fifth set, and Federer just advanced. He's the oldest guy to advance to the third round since Ken Roswell at 40 years old did in 1975. You got an American, Francis Tiafoe, who defeated a number four seed, and he's now made it to the third round. I think it's really exciting because of how wide open Wimbledon is on both the men's and the women's draw.
I agree. Eight out of the top 11 female seeds on the women's side are out. So now you have someone, 17-year-old Coco Gauff from America. She's an exciting young player to watch. She has just advanced. So it's a wide open field. There may not be, you know, on the women's
wide
side.
A wide open wet field.
Do not get injured. Be very careful.
All right. We didn't even get to the Dodgers, but next time. Jason and Randy Sklar, also known as the Sklar Brothers, check out their podcast. It's called View from the Cheap Seats. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, you.
Madeline.
Coming up, a group of nuns here in Hollywood rebelled against the strict rules of the LA Archdiocese.
Clothing, time to pray, place where to work, limited to teaching and nursing. And we wanted to go beyond that, and mostly to be self-determining.
How the Immaculate Heart nuns defied the Cardinal and the Vatican. That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, the 1950s weren't exactly banner years for women's independence. Women were mostly expected to marry and have kids, keep house. But for those who didn't want that, surprisingly, the Catholic Church offered an escape.
In those days, I was surrounded by some of the best women you could ever meet. And these were all people in different fields. I'm sure if I had been a nice, proper housewife, I would not have, you know, bumped into all of these ideas. And then, of course, once they get into you, you start noticing and expanding, too.
That's the artist Carita Kent. She was one of the Sisters of the Immaculate Heart of Mary, a Catholic order in Hollywood. The sisters owned and operated Immaculate Heart College. There, they and their students explored subjects well beyond Bible scripture. And that led to clashes with the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. After the Second Vatican Council nudged the church closer to the modern world in 1965, the sisters saw an opening to further exert their independence, including ditching the standard wardrobe, you know, the long dress and veil.
Why dressing as a medieval woman dresses would make one more Christian, more holy? It's hard now to figure out. We have to drive cars, we have to board planes, we have to do all kinds of things that make this out of place.
That's Anita Caspary, the leader of the Sisters of the Immaculate Heart at the time. She's one of the subjects of the new documentary Rebel Hearts, directed by Pedro Kos. Lenore Dowling was an Immaculate Heart sister and is also one of the subjects of the film. And when I spoke with them earlier, I began by asking Pedro Kos to describe what LA's archdiocese was like at the time under the leadership of Cardinal McIntyre, who had come here from the East Coast.
Cardinal McIntyre, before he was a priest or before he entered the seminary, he was actually a runner on Wall Street. So he had a very savvy business mind. But theologically speaking, he was actually very conservative and very much old school patriarchal mindset of the way things should run. So when he came to Los Angeles, I believe he came here in 1948, and to take charge of the Los Angeles Archdiocese, he oversaw one of the greatest expansion periods of the archdiocese at that time by building parishes, building schools, building hospitals. And so this was a place that was booming. Southern California, mm-hmm. Los Angeles was really booming after the war. And, you know, they felt that they needed more parishes, more schools for the influx of new people that were coming in. But it really required, by building up schools, what do you need? You need teachers, and you need lots of them. And what better at that time, what better teachers than, you know, sisters and nuns, mm-hmm. who staffed these schools with very little, almost no compensation at all, because, you know, they lived in convents and orders. That was the way.
Right. And had taken a vow of poverty. And Lenore, so were you one of those teachers that filled these new schools?
Yes. After I was professed, like all the others, I was missioned to teach at Queen of Angels High School. And because there were so many schools, all of us began to teach right away as soon as we put on the black veil. And that was a point of contention because Anita Caspary wanted us to be educated and credentialed. And she told the Cardinal she would withdraw the sisters from the schools in order to get us educated, which did happen. But that was one of the points of contention.
So there were huge class sizes and this immediate demand for your services, and you weren't trained. And here you had to oversee, what, like 60 students in a class or something like that? That must have been really overwhelming.
Well, I didn't teach in elementary school, and many of our members who taught elementary did experience 60 to 80 students in a class. I taught in the high school, so it was a normal 20 to 30 students. And our students didn't know we were neophytes in the classroom. But I had had 1 year of college, which wasn't a lot.
No, one year of college? Wow.
And the archdiocese really relied on the Immaculate Heart Order at that time. They were the largest order staffing Los Angeles schools. And, you know, as the archdiocese grew, the situation, as Lenore said, grew really to a breaking point in many ways.
Right. And so it was this labor issue, but it was also, as I mentioned in the intro, Vatican II really pushing for a relaxation of the old rules, the old standards. So then what happened from your perspective, Lenore? That, as you say, there was building tension between the sisters at Immaculate Heart and the Archdiocese, especially in particular with the Cardinal. What was it that made it come to a head?
Well, we were faithful readers following Vatican Council, and we wanted to be faithful to the call to be part of the modern world. And the issues that the Cardinal objected to were disciplinary, clothing, time to pray, place where to work, limited to teaching and nursing. And we wanted to go beyond that and mostly to be self-determining. There were some who didn't want to be teachers, so they went in later into law and social services and healthcare. So to be self-determining with our work, to pray as we wanted, when we could, depending on work, to live where we wanted to live because of new jobs. So our perspective was for our filling out the lives we committed to do, to be of service to people. And I was in New York in 65 at Columbia, and I noticed the sisters in New York were far ahead of us. So we had the unfortunate position of being on the West Coast with Cardinal McIntyre. Other orders were way ahead of us.
And what was it about the habit that really galvanized you and really sparked the Cardinals' outrage. You know, on the face of it, it's just a piece of clothing, but of course it means a lot more. What did it symbolize for you,
well,
Lenore?
For most people, and I had to defend it to my students, it's a symbol that we are other. My students, whom I spoke to afterwards, had put us on the pedestal. So the habit, like all uniforms, separate you, identify you, not necessarily as above, but that's how people looked at us. The collar and the habit say there's a hierarchy and we are above you. So we wanted to be with the people in solidarity with all those whom we served. And the habit can be a barrier. We were following what Vatican Council called for, a new mission, a new life, a new identity.
And Pedro, how did Cardinal McIntyre see the habit? He obviously saw it in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, he saw it as a, in many ways, a signal of their service. And I think when you put, as Lenore very aptly said, when you put an uniform on someone, you are creating a separate class, and it's easy to, one, identify and to control. I think that it is, in a way, a means of control. And for the Cardinal, the fact that the Sisters of the Immaculate Heart were shedding the habit and wearing civilian clothes, it's a lot harder to exert that control, that authority. It subverts that symbol of authority, because then they're outside of that very hierarchical pyramid, which at that time was very strong within the church and which the way he saw the world.
One of the, if not the most famous person in the order at Immaculate Heart is Sister Carita Kent, who became a famous artist and who really tangled with the Cardinal. Her art at the time was so vibrant and full of, well, I guess political messaging too, right? I mean, she had texts and bold graphics. The Cardinal didn't appreciate her art, especially how she depicted the Holy Family.
There are letters from the Archdiocese asking Carita not to depict the Holy Family because it was disturbing to parishioners. So she's kind of forced to move into the direction that she moved into with her work, where she was using a lot more text than she was using figures because she was forbidden from depicting the Holy Family specifically.
So was she, for him, really just the embodiment of the Immaculate Heart nuns in total and their, in his eyes, rebelliousness?
I don't know if she was the embodiment. Because of her celebrity, she was, you know, making public who the art department was, who the college was. And I think he was antagonistic to what was going on in our so-called liberal college. We were all anti-war. We were studying racism, the women's movement, throughout the whole faculty. So because of the texture, the context, the climate of the college, and Carita among them, the sisters, I think it was a whole package that he objected to. And he couldn't control. Hardly anybody obeyed him. Carita kept on working in the college. We kept on teaching, but we all had to make a decision when we were issued an ultimatum.
And so the Vatican gets involved. This becomes a big issue, this fight between the sisters and the Cardinal. And the Vatican sends some bishops with some rules that the nuns have to follow or else.
By order of Rome, these were the points to be followed.
Meet daily for some religious exercises in common.
It said we had to follow the same prayer schedule for everybody at the same time.
The sisters should keep in mind their commitment to education.
In other words, every sister was to be a teacher.
The sisters must observe collaboration with the local ordinaries.
We were to follow the regulations of the cardinal. He was the boss.
Wear a uniform habit.
And one little interesting tidbit is that the Immaculate Heart Sisters were a pontifical order. They actually answered directly to the Pope. But because of the patriarchal nature of the institution of the Catholic Church, ended up that Cardinal McIntyre really forced the hand of the Vatican to issue these 4 points. And therefore, this was an ultimatum.
Right. So then the sisters hold a vote and they decide whether they're going to abide by these rules and stay or leave. And Lenore, what was that like for you?
Well, it was a time of decision-making, consulting one another, feeling in solidarity with those who wanted to follow a path that was unknown, but feeling confidence in our leadership. And so some simply left. It was too ambiguous. What are we going to do? How are we going to live? We don't have jobs. We don't have money. Others, about 62, decided to stay obedient to the local ordinary and remain nuns. And so the rest of us, 315, decided that we would form a community. And we pledged to follow our mission, to serve those with whom we worked, and to hope that even though we were going into an unknown future, God would bless our path.
And did you have any second thoughts about that? Did you have any regrets at all about making such a breach with the Catholic Church, which you had taken vows, lifelong vows at the time?
Well, for many, it was heartbreaking. To many, the vows were the core of religious life. I didn't feel that way. And no, we don't have vows, but we have a yearly commitment. We put it in writing. So every year we make a commitment to community, to God, to our mission.
And you are politically active, right? And socially active.
Yes. Members are involved in environmental issues. I'm on a commission for justice for immigrants and refugees. And I'm on a group that's called Task Force on Anti-Racism. It's a call to the church to work for social justice. So it's part of our mission.
Lenore Dowling is a former sister of the Immaculate Heart and one of the subjects of the film Rebel Hearts. Pedro Kos is the director of the movie. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
And Rebel Hearts is playing at the Lemley Glendale this weekend. Coming up, a big outdoor food hall, Smorgasburg, is reopening this weekend. Evan Kleinman is here with some highlights, and that's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bam right there.
Pie.
Well, good news. Smorgasburg LA is back this weekend. The outdoor food market in the Arts District reopens on the 4th of July after a nearly 16-month hiatus because of the pandemic. So, what will change? Evan Kleinman is here to tell us. She hosts KCRW's Good Food. Well, hello.
Hello there.
Well, for those who don't know what we're talking about, what is Smorgasburg LA?
So, adjacent to the repurposed high-end shopping area known as The Row on Alameda in downtown LA is a produce market. That has been a produce market since early in the previous century. But during the weekend, when it shuts down, it's this large open air space. And Smorgasburg LA opened up there. So it's this outdoor food marketplace. Think of it like Grand Central Market with a transient vendor population, but outside. So it's a place that you can browse your food, enjoy it with your friends. Everybody can find something delicious to eat. And you can do it all outside, which I think for some people right now is really important.
Right. And so why has it been closed this whole time when other places, outdoor places, were open?
It's mystifying to Smorgasburg management. They never really understood how Grand Central Market could have permission to operate all throughout the pandemic, and they didn't have that ability. So they were just thrilled when they got permission to reopen.
Oh, so they weren't given permission by the city, is that right?
Yeah, the health department had not shut them down. And then didn't give them permission to reopen. Who knows? I mean, it could have been that the county health department was stretched and they didn't want to have to oversee it every weekend. Maybe the permits are different because it's just once a week rather than permanent brick and mortar spaces for all these operators. But for whatever reason it was closed, the fact that it has reopened for me is one of the elements that has really signaled that the city really is reopening.
And what is special there in terms of what you can get to eat? Give us some highlights.
Well, the thing I love about it is that there are some vendors who have been there for a long time who do have brick and mortar places, other places in the city, but maybe farther out. So Smorgasburg is an opportunity for you to just go down to downtown LA and get one of their delicious things. Burritos La Palma is a place like that. It's also a place where there's sometimes a bit of churn, so you get to see the latest pop-ups. You get to see people who are in sort of a sophomore place in their career where they have done the initial pop-up thing and maybe they're soon moving to a brick and mortar, and they use Smorgasburg to and Instagram to build an audience. There's so much good food there, and you know, I'm just really thrilled that all the vendors are going to get an opportunity to find their audience once again.
And you can also order delivery, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you can also order delivery, I believe, through Grubhub.
It's called Smorg Delivered, I believe.
Yes, Smorg Delivered.
Smorg Delivered. Smorg. So will you be there on July 4th?
No, I think I'm going to do something else on July 4th, but I definitely will go, if for no other reason than to go to Los Dorados, which is a new entry there, but is a food truck that's gotten a lot of attention over the past year because they're making what appears to be the most delicious flautas in the city. They're just insane looking on Instagram. One of the other things that is really special about Smorgasburg, and only in a city like LA would we actually talk about parking as a talking point. But the parking structure at the Row is so enormous, over 4,000 spaces, that it gives you an opportunity to, for example, if you want to go on a taco crawl, park once, and then just crawl around the Smorgasburg space using the lines as a way to get your appetite back.
You can also go shopping nearby and then go back.
That's true. That's true. You can go in and out. I sort of get caught, though.
All right, so what else? What else is delicious at Smorgasburg?
Well, let me give you what I would do for a taco crawl. So the places that are coming back that are beloved favorites are Burritos La Palma, Tacos 1986, Machin, and Evil Cooks. Evil Cooks is famous for their octopus trompo. So like a meat shawarma, they just stick a ton of octopus on that skewer and it rolls around, and then they make tacos, tortas, all kinds of things with it. New are Los Dorados and Goat Mafia. Mafia does a birria, a goat birria, and they have, we've all heard about all the birria tacos around town, but they're also making a birria tamal. Then there are vegan favorites, Cena Vegan and Todo Verde. So really, if you just want to go for tacos there, that is a great choice. But then there's a great representation of some of the best pivots and pop-ups that LA Cooks did during the pandemic, who are coming for the first time. And in that category, I would say Bridgetown Roti, Go-Go Bird, Little Fry, Little Salty Pie Company, and Saucy Chick Rotisserie. Really good.
Okay, so a good sign that the pandemic is mostly in our rearview mirror. Mostly.
Let's hope.
Indeed. And we will have your full list online, of course, at kcrw.com. Evan Kleinman, host of KCRW's Good Food. You can hear that Saturday mornings at 11. Thank you, Evan, and happy 4th of July.
Thank you, Madeline. Same to you. I can't believe it's July.
Well, me neither. Hey, thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and yeah, I'll see you tomorrow.